Good evening, everybody. My name is Sky, and I'm here with the Rec Forum. Tonight's panel is Mass Incarceration in the Margins, Women Trans in the Prison Industrial Complex. First, I'd like to introduce our moderator. Janae Clover is currently an intern at the Center for Community Alternatives, where she assists in various youth projects. She was born in Lower Manhattan and raised throughout the city. She is 17 and attends Brooklyn Bridge Academy High School and is currently the founder of the Youth Generation. Youth Generation's mission is to stop youth from being in prison, also to help youth speak about how they feel about the policing court system. She's very happy to be here and speak for all of you today. Tanisha Douglas was raised in a prison, visiting her father, who was doing a 30 to life in a New Jersey maximum security prison. She is currently a clinical supervisor at the Center for Community Alternatives and an alternative to detention program, and is excited to be here as well. Thank you very much.
Are you all excited for this right now?
Yeah.
I'm excited. Should I use the mic? Okay, use the mic. So can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So welcome everyone to this panel discussion on a topic that couldn't be more timely, as the UN has declared today International Women's Day. Do folks know that? Yes. And so it's a beautiful day for us to be talking about what's going on with women, what's going on with folks who are oppressed as a result of their gender identity, and particularly looking at the prison industrial complex and its impact on that oppression, as well as the amazing, overwhelming resistance movements that have been taking place to push back and challenge the system that's oppressing us all. But before we get into sort of the juicy stuff and the panelists get going, I find that oftentimes you come to these events, when you come by yourself or you come with some people you know, and you leave by yourself and you leave with the same people that you came with. But what we know about movement building is that it's so important for us to build unity. Do folks agree with that?
Yes.
So I'm a huge fan of popular education, so I'm going to do a little teeny tiny activity. Can y'all get with it a little
bit? Yes.
Okay, just to break the ice a little bit, you know? So if you can look around the room, maybe just find a person you haven't seen before, or maybe you've seen once before but haven't really had a chance to dialogue with in the past, and maybe just for the next 90 seconds, connect with that person, say hello, talk about what brought you to the event today. Let's just build with each other a little bit, and then we'll get started with the listening, okay? Go for it. Four times. That was amazing! Okay. How was that for folks? Kind of a good exercise? Excellent, awesome. So at this point, we'll just get into it. We have a panel of amazing, accomplished, passionate, brilliant individuals. And Janae is going to let us know a little bit about each of them before we ask them some questions and they get into their remarks. And then we will open up for a community dialogue about these issues. Does that sound like an okay plan?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, Janae, are you ready?
Mm-hmm. Hi, everybody. Hi. My name is Janae, and I first want to introduce Laura Whitehorn. Laura Whitehorn is a former political prisoner and prison justice activist, editor of the War Performed by Sophia Bukhari, I'm sorry.
That's okay, no one should be
welcome. Should we welcome from my home? The next person is Victoria Law. Victoria Law is a writer, photographer, zenist, and a mother. She is a co-founder of Books Through Bars, NYC, the author of Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women, and the editor of Tanisha's. I am writing from Lumina Prison. Her most recent project, Don't Leave Your Friends Behind, examines how social justice movements and communities can support parents, children, and families. Okay, please give a hand to the Tina Reynolds is a co-founder and chairwoman on the Rise Telling Her Story Words. Women on the Rise Telling Her Story Words is an association of formerly and currently incarcerated women who have been empowered by their own experiences while involved in the criminal justice system and beyond. Through mutual support, leadership development, organizing, and telling our stories through transforms the lives of women who have been directly impacted by incarceration and changes public
perception
and policy. Reynolds has received a master in social work from Hunter College. She is currently a professor at York SUNY in psychology department, teaching the impact of incarceration on families, communities, and children. She has published pieces on the abolition of prisons, the impact of incarceration on women and children from incarcerated women, and policy change, and is an editor of an anthology, Erupted Life, experiences of incarceration women in the United States. Can you please give it up? Sunny Farwell organized the New York State Prisoner Justice Network and is interested in building lived unity around the politics of prison abolition. And last but not least, we have Rena. Rena lives in Brooklyn and works at the Silver River Door Project, working with low-income people and transgender people who are transgender and gender non-conforming. She believes creativity, imagination, and
are crucial
for self-determination and liberation. Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much, Shane, for introducing the panelists. So the first question we wanted to open up with Victoria. Okay. You down with it?
Mm.
Okay. The first question for Victoria is, how has this country historically used and developed prisons?
Okay. Well, okay, this is going to be a little hard because you're all scattered like that. Mass incarceration, as we know it, was developed as a means of social control, mostly to control people of different races, mostly African American people, but also people who were just not white or not classified as white. And it's also been used to control gender behavior as well. So women, and if we think back to the behaviors, people who might have been considered by today's standards gender non-conforming and trans, but they didn't have those terms back then. So I want to give a couple of statistics and historical facts to kind of ground what we're thinking of when we think about prisons and mass incarceration today. So as of December 31st, 2007, there were approximately 2.3 million people in federal or state prisons or in local jails. As of June 30th, 2009, there were 115,000 women behind bars. Today, the International Center for Prison Studies in England just released a report stating that there are more than 625,000 women and girls in pretrial detention or in prison internationally across the world. Nearly one-third of that number, 201,200, are in the U.S. So the U.S. incarcerates one-third of the women's jail and prison population. This only accounts for people in women's jails and women's prisons. This doesn't include the numbers of people who identify as women who are kept in male prisons or male jails. Now, lest you think like, well, it just means that more people are doing bad things to each other, there's a historical context of prisons as a means of social control. shortly after the Civil War, Southern states that had used slavery to control black people instituted the Black Codes, which basically criminalized actions, but only if the person who did those actions was black. So this meant that people who were standing on a sidewalk, who were out after a certain hour, who were unemployed, who were not doing anything that the white power structure did not want them to do, would be criminalized, and they would be arrested and sent to jail. Oftentimes they would have to pay a fine, and because many of them didn't have the means to pay the fine, they were then sent to work off their fines, basically reenacting slavery under this idea of county convicts, or they would be leased, if they had longer sentences, prisons would lease them out to private corporations. Does that sound familiar? To work off their debt. So former slaves would then work in fields, they would work in coal mines, and they would basically be doing many of the same things that they had been doing under slavery. If a white person was caught standing on a corner, being unemployed, being out after a certain hour, et cetera, that white person was not charged with anything and was free to go about his or her business, or I should say his business, because later on I'll get to how these same laws and these same rules control gender behavior as well. And this drastically changed the nature and the color of what prisons look like in the South. Because I specialize in incarcerated women's issues and resistance, I'm going to give you a few facts about how this changed what women's incarceration looked like in the South. Between 1831 and 1859, prior to the Civil War, only 3 of Tennessee's 24 women prisoners were black. In 1868, however, after the Black Codes were passed, 100% of Tennessee's women prisoners were black. So basically it changed what prisons looked like. In Alabama, again, prior to the abolition of slavery, 99% of people in Alabama prisons were white, and shortly after the Black Codes were passed, the overwhelming majority of Alabama prisoners were black. Prisons and incarceration have also been used to control gender behavior. So women could be arrested and incarcerated for things like being drunk, for having premarital sex or having extramarital sex, for getting an STD, for quote-unquote keeping bad company, for being pregnant out of wedlock. And keep in mind that men were not arrested or penalized for these same behaviors. In addition to that, under the guise of rehabilitating or reforming them, these women often received longer sentences, even when they were arrested and convicted of what they would call crimes, like petty theft or larceny or stealing something or hurting someone. And this idea that women somehow needed to be reformed or rehabilitated came into play first in 1869 in Michigan, which passed the first indeterminate sentencing law on the grounds that women who were convicted of prostitution would need to be reformed with extensive training. So basically what happened was a woman would be convicted and sent to a reformatory, and it was up to the authorities in the reformatory to determine when she'd been properly rehabilitated. And these reformatories basically taught skills that would be of use if you were, say, a middle to upper class housewife who had nothing to do but to set your table and iron and do your laundry and have everything all nice and neat for your middle class male breadwinner to come home. But for women of lower classes who couldn't afford that, they were basically being taught how to be domestics for this household. Interestingly, at the same time, the Michigan State Legislature rejected a proposal for indeterminate sentencing for men, basically assuming that men didn't need that same kind of rehabilitation if they committed crimes. Unless you think, well, that was in the 1800s, in as late as the 1900s, in 1913, Pennsylvania passed what was called the Muncie Act, stating that a woman who was convicted of an offense punishable by more than 1 year would instead receive an indeterminate sentence. And as late as 1966, courts have upheld the sentencing policy. In 1966, a court in Pennsylvania stated that women's quote-unquote inherent physical and psychological differences justified differential treatment. Therefore, it was deemed reasonable for women to receive longer sentences, especially because they supposedly received more effective rehabilitation while incarcerated. Coming into the present day, in the 1960s and 1970s, politicians began to start tying the struggles for civil rights and liberation to people's fear of crime and violence. So in 1965, Lyndon B. Johnson declared a war on crime, and he started to tie this to what was going on in the South and in the North and with people struggling for their rights. In 1973, Richard Nixon vowed to expand that war, and he linked crime to, again, the growing civil unrest around people's rights and people's liberation in this country. 7 years earlier, Nixon actually publicly stated that the increase in crime could be traced back to, quote unquote, the spread of the corrosive doctrine that every citizen possesses an inherent right to decide for himself which laws to obey and when to disobey them. And he was referring to the civil rights movement. So basically what he did was he took people's fear of violence and he mushed that into the civil rights movement and the black liberation struggle and the Chicano liberation struggle and every struggle for liberation in this country to basically start fomenting a hysteria around crime and prison. In 1982, Reagan declared a war on drugs, even though crack did not hit the streets until 3 years later. And all of these wars on crime and drugs sort of came at a time when economic conditions were deteriorating, especially in communities of color. Communities of color were rising up and starting to fight back. And these wars served to lock poor people away before they could organize and challenge social conditions. So when we're talking this evening about all of these realities and people organizing to fight and challenge this, keep in mind that it's not just people have done bad things in a vacuum, but there are all these other forces at play that contribute to this. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Victoria. Sunny, people don't have to put up with this, right?
That's true.
So, what is the role of prison abolition?
Abolition.
Abolition.
I want to start by saying I'm so honored to be up here with all of you. It's really, really honored. And just to get a temperature check in the room, how many folks here are familiar with prison abolition as an idea? Okay, and for how many people is it pretty new? You haven't heard much about prison abolition. Okay, great. So prison abolition, I am by no means an expert, so I'm speaking to you from a place of this has become very important to me. I spend a lot of time thinking about it. If I say things that are wrong, I hope you guys like actually just call me out. My understanding is that prison abolition is basically like other forms of abolition, like slavery abolition, apartheid abolition, you know, abolition of Jim Crow, saying, let's tear the whole thing down. It's not fixable. It's gotta go, right? So let's abolish it. And that doesn't mean that it's not important to really respect the immediate struggles for survival, which are part of many efforts to reform things. So part of the tension between prison reform efforts and prison abolition efforts can come up against that. And I'd like to really think about abolition tonight as a political framework that can absolutely support reform struggles and that also has a larger politics to offer. An example of a prison abolitionist perspective that really supports reformist struggles might be something like the struggle against solitary confinement. So if you want to say solitary confinement is brutal, it's inhumane, it's got to go, that's actually very compatible with an abolitionist framework. Another example might be raising the age of juvenile, being tried as adults. So saying that whole system has to go, like we want to raise the age, that's also compatible with an abolitionist perspective. However, the idea of building, you know, like with prison overcrowding or with like other kinds of brutality, that expanding the prison system would be a good way to address that, that would not be compatible with an abolitionist perspective. An abolitionist perspective doesn't support anything that expands the prison system. So the solution is not going to be to expand. So that's sort of a distinction. And for the most part, in the scale of the prison justice movement as it stands, abolitionist efforts and reformist efforts can absolutely ally together, and there's many examples of that being really successful. So I am an abolitionist, and the one of the ways I think about it is prisons can't be fixed because they're not broken. Because they do what they're supposed to do. They do them, they perform the function that they are supposed to perform really well. And so I want to make a distinction between purpose and function, because in the public conversation, people think about, if you say what are prisons for, you'll hear most people say they're about rehabilitation, they're about punishment, they're about reducing crime, they're about safety, right? So that might be the purpose of prisons. And we can talk about our prisons working to for that purpose. And I think there's some pretty good evidence that they're not, right? So we could say the prison system is broken. But if we talk about the function of prisons, right? Like what, there's popcorn, what do you think of when I say how do prisons function? Like any, what are the words that come to mind? Like what do prisons actually do? So it's has to do with these forms of control of poor people, control of people of color, control of gendered, control of, it's like systematic repression, warehousing of people in times of mass unemployment, right? Like surplus labor that can be released to break a strike at any moment. There's just a whole bunch of ways that prisons actually function that aren't what their supposed purpose is. And yet they do that function really well. So in that sense, it's actually not broken. It's working just fine. So the question is, can we reveal how prisons actually function? Can we reveal the brutality at the core of it? And can we start to talk about dismantling it? I would like to make a case that the left in general should be taking this really seriously. And the reason is, I think that prison abolition as a politic offers a framework for thinking about universal dignity that is unique. Because if we were to really have the thing, have the criteria in place to abolish prisons, we'd have to be thinking about universal basic needs on a level that almost nothing else demands. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong, but when I think about like what would actually sustain a world without prisons as we know them, we can't rely on things like voluntary association or voluntary mutual aid alone. There has to be some attention to, or even in those forms of organizing, thinking about what it would really mean to address basic needs in a far more universal way than sometimes happens. I think that there's something about that that is potentially a kind of problematic for the left that would be worth spending some time thinking about. I also think that the demand of abolition is fundamentally a demand for a deeply transformative politics, in the way that there's a difference between like rent reform, and the demand that housing should not be for profit, or the difference between, we want like a better welfare state and that we should have direct control over the economy. So prison abolition is one of those like fundamentally transformative demands, and so it offers that kind of longer term strategic perspective. I think also a lot of people don't have, many people do not have immediate self-interest or material stakes in beliefs around punishment. So there's this kind of mass consent to prisons based on people thinking that people should be punished. But when it comes right down to it, like ordinary people don't have anything to gain from that. Like we could talk about what ordinary people have to gain from other systems of power and control. But when it comes to this idea that like people should be punished, most people don't actually stand anything to gain from it. So in exposing the reality of what the prison system does, I I think that it's a way to start to chip away at some of those systems of consent in a way that's much harder to do with capitalism as a whole, because people do have something to gain, right? Like, there's many ways that there's trade-offs and comforts and but yet it's a similar logic, because if you say prisons aren't broken, they work just fine as a system of repression and control, it's a similar logic to saying capitalism isn't broken, it doesn't need to be reformed, it actually works very well to do what it does, which is to consolidate wealth for the few. So I think of prison abolition as kind of training wheels for a certain type of thinking that that might have an easier time getting off the ground in on the level of consciousness. And I don't know if that's true, but it's a deep hope that that is something that we could push.
Thank you so much. Thank you. So Laura, you have a wealth, a lifetime, some would say, of experience with the prison system as well as in revolutionary activism. Can you speak about your experience and also about the importance of prison justice prison justice initiatives and activism?
Oh, I can try. Sorry for my back. First of all, thanks, and Sky, thanks for starting this off, and thanks to all of you for pulling it together. And I just wanted to say that we see this as the beginning of a discussion, a series of discussions. And for me, personally, that's partly because I think that the prison abolition movement, the prison reform movement, whatever it is at this point, is lacking a very big piece, which is consciousness around how repression functions based in what it does to women and trans and gender non-conforming people in particular. So I want to talk about that from my own experience. And the main thing, since I don't have much time, is just what happened inside prison. So what happened inside prison, first of all, I went to prison as a political prisoner. That means I committed illegal acts that were as part of political movements. They were actions against the government. Some political prisoners are in because they're targeted for their beliefs and locked up even though they had nothing to do with the crime that they're convicted of. There are different categories. But and I did 14 years in federal and local prisons because I was moved around a lot. And what I saw was genocide. I saw mostly black and Latina women and some trans, although there weren't that many, but there certainly were some. And I saw everything that Vicky talked about in terms of trying to control women and make us behave in a certain way. And I also saw how when we talk about prisons as repression, whether we're talking about the whole prison population or political prisoners, repression also means preventing any of those struggles from rising again. So it's no accident that the mass incarceration boom started in 1970 or so, which is also the year that was, you know, kind of a fulcrum point for the black liberation movement in particular. So, and I saw women who were of childbearing years locked up for huge sentences because what prisons do in the United States is, as Sonny was talking about, is that they generate a culture that we then accept of permanent punishment. You know, you trip on the sidewalk, someone's going to pay. Someone pushes you, they're going to pay. Everything's about punishment. Nothing is about reconstructing social relations and basing them in love and humanity. So I saw women who were doing, I mean, I had a cellmate once who was doing 16 years for a guy that she was in a relationship with who had a gun in her their apartment and was dealing drugs, and she wouldn't testify against him. And that was, because it was the federal system, that was endemic. There were so many women in for these things called girlfriend crimes. All right, so they're locked up. Either they have a young child and they can't raise the child, and the child is, you know, sent either to elderly, the woman's elderly parents are in foster care. The family is undermined, destroyed. Or they don't have children because they're locked up, and of course, since you're not a human being when you're in prison, sex is illegal. You know, in my HIV work, I said this, and I don't know, why don't we demand that sexuality is a human right, and as such, it should be permitted in prisons, and not only a tiny handful of prisoners in the United States should have a right to trailer visits and family visits. Anyway, so I saw that. What does that do? That is part of the UN definition of genocide. Destroying the future generations of particular oppressed nations. And in this case, it was black women and Latina women that I mostly saw, and other women of color, but those were the majority of this. We were, and this is one of the things that has stayed with me and I think has done lasting damage, we were constantly pat-searched by men, constantly. And those of us who were known to be lesbians were attacked in that, sexually attacked, and we sometimes fought back and ended up doing, you know, whole time for it, and sometimes we initiated complaints and petitions. You know, people don't take these things, women don't take this all passively, but it was part of enforcing a view. You are a piece of sex for a man, and the constant monitoring of women in the shower areas, the cell areas, the toilet areas by men. It's a threat of sexual abuse that destroys people's personalities. So what are they doing with this form of repression? They're destroying, or trying to destroy, communities. They're trying to destroy the base from which revolutionary struggle, or even just reformist struggle, from which struggle emerges. And that's, I think, the particularity of what it means to say that prisons are about repression. So I just want to give a couple of examples of what happens in the prison movement, however that is defined, when women and trans people and sexual, gender non-conforming people are not included in the conversation. So first of all, that would be missing this element of what it means to destroy resistance and destroy communities. It's not just about saying to people, if you march on the White House, we'll lock you up. I mean, that is part of it. But it's about, as I said, trying to destroy communities so there is no threat of any kind of resistance. If you take women out of the equation, you don't see that, the depth of that. All you see is the part of it that affects the broadest part of the community, sort of in general terms, disenfranchisement, things like that, which are very real. If you don't look at women, for example, I was in a control unit, and I was in the control unit with three other North American women political prisoners. And at the time we were in the control unit, the Marion control unit had been, there was protest against it, and so a paper had been written about what is a control unit, and it described it all by the conditions that men face in control units, and nothing was about the purpose. Well, when they put women in control units, the conditions are different, because the forms of repression and control are more sexual threat and less overt brutality. So they couldn't get that the purpose of control units is to change people's associations, ideology, and behavior if women are left out of that. So I think that those are a couple of things. Just one other thing. Go to a visiting room for a men's prison and it's full of women coming to visit. Go to a visiting room for a woman's prison and it's full of women coming to visit. And that's another part of the whole question of prisons and their impact on communities that doesn't get talked about enough, is the impact on families. When you have a lesbian partner on the outside, there's a particularity to it, which if anyone wants to talk about it, maybe some people sitting in the audience can. When you're a family, when you're a child, you know, it is another part of that. So I would just say finally, to agree with Sunny about what's so important about talking about abolition, we have to construct a different society, whatever we do. So prison abolition is one place to start, and if we want to fight, if we want to be communities to exist, to fight, we have to stop it.
Thank you. Thank you. Transgender people are also hugely impacted by prison system. How do you see this impact within your community and the broader trans community?
That's a great question. Remind me never to follow Laura. I'm still processing everything that you said.
Well, that's how I felt about digging in sometimes.
Yeah, it's hard. And, you know, these conversations are so heavy at times, right? And they can really, especially those of us who have navigated the prison industrial complex, they can bring up a lot of, just talking about it, in our body, a lot of pain and grief and sorrow. And those are really important feelings to acknowledge and to have and to hold in this room. So I was thinking about what I was going to say, and I was like, maybe I should tell a joke. So, you know, we start laughing. And it turned out my joke was really bad. you know, I practiced for the past couple of days. I, you know, practiced with my partner and at work. And the feedback that I got was, read the room, and if the room is, like, here for you to tell the joke, then you should do it. And if not, you should, you know, try to get laughter in other ways. So I tried to get laughter in other ways. Just like imagination and creativity, joy and laughter are so central to creating an abolitionist culture and a resistance culture, and one that transforms the prison industrial complex. Mm-hmm. So I work at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, and what we do is a lot. But our mission is to ensure that all people have access, regardless of race, gender, sexual orientation, class, ability. All people are free to self-determine their gender. And how we do that is through a number of strategies. One is through the law. We have a brilliant team of lawyers who do free legal services for low-income people, people of color, who are transgender and gender nonconforming, because we know our community is disproportionately impacted by the prison industrial complex. So our lawyers, we have an intake. People come on Thursday. That was today. It was a long day because the office is packed, because there are few organizations providing these kind of services by people who are also trans and gender nonconforming. That's something that's particularly unique to the Sylvia Rivera Law Project. So we do it through the law. We also do it by supporting the organizing of trans and gender nonconforming people who are currently locked up. And that's a really important part. You know, we do it through the Prisoner Advisory Committee. So it's a lot about supporting people's own organizing, right? The people on the inside. And just to preface, we think about detention in the prison industrial complex in a pretty expansive way. So whether it's being locked up in a psychiatric institution, whether it's your homeless shelter, which the Department of Homeless Services in New York City has its own police force, and it's regularly regulating access into homeless shelters, whether it's a prison, whether it's jail, whether it's ICE detention center, we really want to be expansive when we're thinking about the prison industrial complex and supporting the people who are most impacted, who are trans and gender nonconforming. And then we have organizing, where, and that's the work that I do as part of the movement building team. I work with people who are low income, people of color, transgender, and gender nonconforming to organize around issues that are affecting us. So whether that is a detention center, lockup, whether it's accessing healthcare in an emergency room or accessing in community centers, or right now we're doing a big campaign on Medicaid, because we know the majority of our community doesn't have consistent income and relies on Medicaid, and Medicaid doesn't cover costs that are related to our health. And one of the things that's related to our health is our gender identity. So it doesn't cover anything related to gender identity. So that's a really big campaign. So I just wanted to explain what the Sylvia Rivera Law Project does. But one of the things that's super important to me, too, is to bring in actually who Sylvia Rivera was. Because a lot of times we talk about Sylvia Rivera Law Project and people in the room. How many people have heard of Sylvia Rivera? Great, wonderful. So Sylvia Rivera was a trans activist. She was born July 2nd, 1950 in the South Bronx, a Latina trans activist. And she was 19 during the Stonewall Rebellion. And the Stonewall Rebellion was a fight right down the street, on Christopher Street, against the policing of our community, trans communities, gender nonconforming people, but particularly those of us who are low income and people of color. And the Stonewall Rebellion, some people say, it helped, you know, kick off the modern queer movement. So it's really important that what kicked off the modern queer movement was a resistance to policing and the policing of our communities. And I think that needs to be held in this space. And Sylvia Rivera was one of the people who helped do that by throwing Molotov cocktails at the cops. And you know, so that's what she actually did. And then a couple years later, she formed STAR, Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, after having worked with Huey B. Newton and the Young Lords at the Philadelphia Revolutionary People's Convention. Huey B. Newton came up to her and was like, "I remember you, you're that queen from New York." You know, she was very active in struggles in New York City, in radical struggles that didn't relate to queer people or trans people. And in reflection, in 2001, she gave this talk at Latino Gay Men of New York, and she was talking about why trans people were allowed in the Black Panthers or the Young Lords, and it was because trans people were so gung-ho and oftentimes were the frontliners. She was the first person in so many actions to be arrested, right? And so were other trans people, which is particularly important to note because trans people, our lives are regulated by the police and by the jails and prison detention centers all every day, right? Whether we're walking from the subway to our, you know, if we have a job, to our job, or if we're on welfare, to the welfare office or homeless shelter, we often get stopped, right? And there's this campaign right now called Stop and Frisk. And one of the things that, you know, we would love to see is how Stop and Frisk is a great campaign, but our community is affected by Stop and Strip Search, right? So police officers, NYPD officers, regularly come up to us and do gender checks by strip searching us on the street to figure out what we have between our legs. And that's also how we're housed in the prison industrial complex. The good news is that we also have a really rich legacy of resistance, right? So whether it was Sylvia Rivera's forming STAR, Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, or working with the Young Lords and the Black Panthers, or whether it was organizing that happens today through the Transforming Justice Alliance, where formerly incarcerated trans women are coming together under, you know, already talking about abolition and how to abolish the prison industrial complex, or whether it was a campaign that we were all a part of to stop the welfare office, HRA, being so transphobic when we need to access HRA to get benefits to survive in New York City when we're regularly underemployed and discriminated against in employment. That's the good news. Like, we're doing we have a really rich legacy of resistance. The challenging bad news is, if you didn't know this history, one of the things is historical erasure of our communities is real. There's a reason why people don't know the history of Sylvia Rivera and the history of STAR, and it's because radical communities so often push us out and eject us. In 1973, Sylvia Rivera got up on stage in Washington Square Park and was talking to the crowd at the Christopher Street Liberation Rally and said, "You all need to remember about your brothers and sisters who are currently incarcerated." And she was kicked off stage and kicked off the movement. And there's a long legacy of trans women, particularly trans women, being ejected from radical spaces. And that's something that, as activists and abolitionists, we really have to engage. And we really have to talk and think about how we may or may not be contributing to the exiling of people who are most impacted by the prison industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And that's a conversation I'm really excited to have with everyone here.
Thank you so much, Raina.
Thank you. Yeah.
Sunny. So cis women, and those are women whose assigned sex matches their gender identity, right? And trans women could really be allies in this struggle around the prison industrial complex. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Just super briefly, as a way of pushing back against that erasure, where, you know, even radical spaces, people kind of see at best this idea of like inclusion, right? Like, we should have trans inclusion. And I just want to push back against that for a second by saying this is especially apparent around the prison industrial complex, but in general, that knowledge is on the side of those most impacted, right? So like, in terms of prisons, like, anything that might be considered a central issue about state violence in terms of prisons plays out on trans and gender nonconforming people's bodies in a way that is stark and high stakes. And anything that might be considered a woman's issue also plays out with transgender nonconforming people in a way that actually could inform feminism that's grounded in gender liberation, so that the blind spots where more privileged women and cis women kind of capitulate to power, those blind spots are not there for trans people. They're not. And that starkness is something that is so important for us to see, and it's knowledge that the radical left needs. And so the idea of inclusion is a really feeble framework for what it would actually mean to benefit greatly from the struggles and resistance and to like actually be allies and work together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks so much. Victoria, what are some of the challenges facing women in prison and resistance movement?
Okay. For your first question, I'm going to actually turn it over to the audience. So if you let me know when 2 minutes is up, and then I'll move on to resistance. So the first question was, what are some of the challenges facing women in prison? And for this, I'm going to turn it over to the audience and see what you think of. So if I say women in prison, what are some of the issues and challenges that come to mind when I say that? Just call something out.
Children.
Over 80% of women in prison are mothers to children, at least half of them to minor children. How many of you have heard of the Adoption and Safe Families Act? So in 1997, Congress passed the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which states that, I'm going to stand up because I can't see everybody, which states that if a child has been in foster care for 15 of the past 22 months, the state has to start terminating all parental rights to this child. And only 2 states at the time made exceptions for the placement of the child in foster care if the parent was in prison. New York State recently passed an expanded discretion act to the Adoption and Safe Families Act after years of advocating and pushing from people. But that still leaves 47 other states in which if a parent is in prison and their child is in foster care after 15 months, the state starts to terminate their parental rights. And what that means is that the parent has no more rights to that child than someone in the grocery store. And this affects women disproportionately more than men because of the way that our society is gendered to see parenting. So when a father goes to prison, oftentimes he's got a female relative who will step up and take care of his children. Not always, but more often than when a mother goes to prison. When a mother goes to prison, oftentimes she's already a single head of household, or her partner is arrested alongside of her, or because of the way we gender parenting again, if her partner is male, might say, like, you know what, I don't raise children, you know, and so incarcerated mothers' children are 5 times more likely to end up in foster care than incarcerated fathers. Other issues that come to mind.
I have a question about that, is because I know with male prisoners, we hear so much about
that. Can we just hold questions till the end, because okay, I just want to kind of get through the, like, okay, challenges, and then, you know, go on to resistance. Thanks.
Education.
The majority of women in prison don't have a high school or college level education. There's statistics that show that education in prison for women in prison is actually less than they would get if they were a man in a male prison. Other issues?
Enforcing passivity?
Yes. There are rules in women's prisons that are not enforced or punished in male prisons. So in a lot of women's prisons, if they're cursing, they will actually get written up. Whereas what I'm told is that in men's prisons, you can curse all you want, and it's not actually an infraction of the rules.
Getting rid of my guard.
Yes, sexual abuse and sexual violence. Under the Equal Employment Act of 1964, male guards were allowed to work in women's prisons, and women's prisons, women were allowed to work in male prisons. And this was without regard as to where in the prison they might be placed. And as a result, there's been like rampant amounts of sexual abuse and sexual violence in prisons, often perpetrated by people who are employed in the prisons. A couple of other quick things. Oh, yeah?
Medical issues.
Medical issues, yes.
prisons have atrocious medical care. Like, when I say these things, I don't mean that, like, men in prison are living the high life and, like, you know, having cocktails and stuff. I'm just saying that, like, if men have nothing, women have less than nothing, trans people have less than nothing. You know, it's that spectrum of, like, you know, gross injustice. But prisons often don't have women-specific health care for things like breast cancer, cervical cancer, OBGYN services, pregnancy. In 36 states, or maybe it's 35 states, Florida may or may not have just passed a bill against it. Women are still shackled when they are in labor, so a pregnant woman will actually be handcuffed, and then there will be a chain that goes to her belly, and then her legs will be shackled as she is in labor and being brought to the hospital. And it is up to the guard on duty, not the medical staff, when those shackles come off.
And they're strip searched coming and going.
And they are strip searched coming and going to and from the medical visits. And then also there's abuse and battering. More than half of women in state prisons and jails report having experienced physical and or sexual abuse prior to coming to prison, most often from family members or loved ones. And women are 3 times more likely than men to have been physically or sexually abused prior to incarceration. Now, I bring all these up because if we're not seeing these as prison issues, you know, if we're seeing these just as like women's issues but not related to prisons and prison movements and prison organizing, then we're not seeing what the resistance to these issues look like. So I'm going to give one example of the kind of resistance that women in prison have done that doesn't often get seen as prison organizing or prison resistance because we don't see these issues. So in the late 1980s, in the women's prison in Ohio, a group of women with long sentences formed the Life Group, Looking Inward for Excellence. And originally it was supposed to be just a support group where women were just like supporting each other through their long sentences. And over time, they started asking each other, like, you know, what are you in here for, you know? And they realized that many of them were serving life sentences for killing their abusers. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the late 1980s, when a lot of people didn't talk about abuse. Mm-hmm. They didn't know what abuse was. This doesn't come into play if you are on trial for killing somebody, is whether or not you had been abused. Nobody was talking about domestic violence. And they started organizing around domestic violence. And this morphed into a campaign for clemency for women convicted of self-defense against their batterers. And they just didn't limit it to themselves. They actually went out onto their units and into the common areas, and they spoke with other women. So they asked them, you know, what are you in here for? You know, like, wait, you're in here for killing your partner. You know, hey, you know, that's actually abuse what happens. You know, like, you didn't deserve to have your arm broken, or you didn't deserve to have this kind of treatment. You know, you didn't deserve this kind of violence, and you shouldn't beat yourself up over it. And we're starting this campaign to get clemency. And they wrote to the governor and they asked him to consider clemency for women who had been incarcerated for defending themselves. And in some instances, women actually did help other women overcome their denial about what was going on, understand abuse, remember specific incidents that they could use in their letters for clemency. And if there was any documentation, like if there was a hospital report or a police report, you know, help them figure out how those could be found to bolster their applications. Mm-hmm. And this led to 18 additional women applying for clemency. Mm-hmm. And in the end, the governor granted 25 of these women clemency. And it was the first mass clemency for women incarcerated for self-defense in this country. And again, this isn't something that we think of when we think of prisoner resistance, you know, because we're not thinking of battered women and domestic violence as a prison issue. And this action led to women in California also starting their own campaign, because newspapers picked up on this action across the nation. Some were sympathetic, others were not, you know, but there was definitely like a lot of outcry about the fact that the governor had pardoned 25 women who had killed their partners. And these women then petitioned the governor of California to grant clemency or consider clemency for every single woman incarcerated in the state of California for self-defense. Mm-hmm. And California, which loves to lock people up, which loves to, you know, throw away the key, said, no, we're not going to consider clemency for every single woman incarcerated in the state of California for self-defense. We're not going to do that. But we will look at this as a letter for clemency for the women who signed this letter. And in the end, the governor granted clemency only to 3 of the women, denied it to 7, and made no effort whatsoever on 24 of those women. Mm. But these women's efforts drew the attention of outside advocates and organizers who continued to organize on their behalf and formed a group called Free Battered Women, which continues to this day under another group called the California Coalition for Women Prisoners. And during that time, their efforts
at educating people and petitioning for freedom has resulted in 35 additional women being released since then. So you can see how the efforts of these women have longer reaching implications than just the three women who were granted clemency. And a little closer to home, I know like I'm running over time, more recently, women who had been formerly incarcerated and currently incarcerated organized to end shackling of women who were pregnant and in labor in New York State, and Tina can talk more about that. But again, it's one of these mass organizing efforts that we don't necessarily think of as prison resistance and prison organizing, because again, we're not looking at pregnancy and birth and how are women giving birth as an issue that people in prison movement should be looking at. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Victoria. And last, but certainly not least, Ms. Tina Reynolds. Can you talk a little bit about what does post-incarceration empowerment look like? And what does it mean to have prison abolition?
Okay, well, I'm really glad to be here and listening to you all. I'm just so in awe of all of you. So thank you. Post-empowerment, I believe that, I want to ask you all a question. Do we think that we can empower people? Do people not come with their own power? They come with their own power. When I came out of prison, you know, I talked to a lot of people who were doing this work on behalf of me and my sisters, and you know how it is, right? And they would come up to me and say that, you know, I'm going to offer you an opportunity to be empowered. And I sat back and I thought about it, and I said, for me to have gone through what I've gone through, I'd have to have some internal power already. So how could you offer me anything that I already have? So post-empowerment, you know, we come through our experiences with power. It's what we do afterwards. But I want to point out something that's really significant. Vicki talked about the trauma that we've experienced prior to incarceration. And when we're incarcerated, we're in a very violent environment. And so the rates of mental illness that we hear about are not true. Women do medicate themselves because of the trauma that's exacerbated during their incarceration. So our numbers are really, really high. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have those mental illnesses that people describe us as being and having. So what do we do with that power, knowing that this is what we're dealing with? We're dealing with the trauma, we're dealing with the things that we've experienced prior to incarceration, the criminalization of ourselves as mothers and how society looks at us as women, and you know, how hard it is for us as women to come out and regain ourselves. We offer women, well, let me just tell you a little bit about what Worth does. And Worth came out of a conversation where women were basically absent. So I would and my colleague, my co-founder, Liz Gaines, would find ourselves at the same meetings, her because her children's father was locked up, and me because I'd been a woman who'd been incarcerated. And we'd find ourselves at these conversations many times, just her and I. And we said, now we know that there are more women out there who are experiencing either having their children's parent in prison or being a woman in prison. And we began to think about it. And she introduced me to some sisters once we came back to New York who'd been working in the criminal justice and human services field. I'd recently come out of prison. I think I was had done five years, and I'd recently come out of prison, so I didn't know who was out here before me. And I met Susan Hallett, who started the Long-Termers Committee with Kathy Boudin in Bedford. And the Long-Termers Committee was the first nonprofit that was incorporated by currently incarcerated women. No one had heard of this. No one had heard of this at all. So there was some history. And I was really amazed and surprised and touched And we all began having a conversation around including the voices of women in these discourses where we were talking about prison because it was absent. We talked about not reinventing the wheel because we knew that there were so many other organizations working with women that were doing direct service. We didn't want to do that. We wanted to offer opportunities for self-expression, for sharing our stories, for coming up with solutions to the practices and the policies that we've experienced during our incarceration and even after our incarceration. And we met for about 3 years from 2002 to about 2004, and then we became an organization. We began organizing, we began having our conversations around what policy we wanted to address, and we joined a partner organization, the Correctional Association, and we infiltrated their committees. And by the numbers, we joined their committees, and we became the voice, and we began to advocate, and we began to lobby, and we began to organize. And while we were in those committees, we began to talk about other issues that needed to be thought of, that needed to be addressed, that needed to be moved on, so that these practices would end in prison. And so we began talking about the Adoption Safe Families Act, and it was 10 to 12 years that we worked on that, and we didn't get it passed until 2010, the expanded discretion law. We talked about the anti-shackling legislation. We didn't get that passed until 10 years after. But we kept talking about it. And we kept taking a lead in our conversations with politicians and kept growing. And so our organizing efforts grew, and we began to include the voices of women inside the prison as well as women who were outside. And we began to become a little bit more courageous. And we began to take on going to the police precinct and asking for our permits to do our direct actions, something that we really didn't want to do, but we needed to do this. And we began to organize, and we began to ask our allies and those that partnered with us to stand by us. So if we were determining what it is that we were going to do next, we would let you know, and we would ask you to be there. And more than likely, you would. So when the anti-shackling legislation came up, we had asked our allies to stand in front of the governor's office. We had asked some of the politicians to come down and to talk about why they should end this particular practice within the prison. I had a conversation with Brian Fisher, who was then the commissioner, who's still now the commissioner of the Department of Correctional Services, which has a totally different name now. But anyway, it's Community Supervision. Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. And I had a conversation with him because we kept meeting, so I thought it was kismet that we kept meeting, and I said, well, listen, we're about to take on the anti-shackling legislation, and I said, what do you know about that? Are women still being shackled? And he says, Tina, I'm telling you, that's not happening. We've ended that. Don't worry about it. Don't even do it. So I said, well, I've heard. Mm-hmm. And so he said to me, well, get their names and get their DIN numbers and let me know who they are. And I said, sure, I'll call you. And of course I didn't call him. I went right to the Daily News and the New York Times, and I went right to my sisters, and we began crafting their stories and then began thinking about solutions. And then we held that second rally, and we asked our allies, would they mind putting pillows underneath their shirts and being handcuffed and sitting out in front of the governor's office? And none of them did. There were 12 of them that sat out in front of the governor's office on the sidewalk. And people started walking by, and then they said, oh my gosh, is this really happening? Because the first rally, they didn't get it. You don't get what 5-point restraints mean. But just the fact that there were women, white women, sitting out in front of the governor's office with pillows and handcuffs on, they were like, oh no, women go to prison pregnant? Well, you know, reproductive injustice, you know, it's not thought of that women go to prison pregnant. And the governor came out of his car, he drove
down into the city and came out of his car saying, I'll sign the bill, I'll sign the bill. Wow. We were thinking, well, you had a wife anyway, right. You got children. Mm-hmm. Should have thought about that sooner, but we had the legislation passed, and it was a huge win for New York. It was a huge win for women. It was a huge win to begin that conversation around reproductive justice, you know, something that had been invisible, something that had not been spoken about, something that is a prison issue. You know, so we at Worth organize. We offer opportunities for women to gain their voices and to share their stories and to offer solutions, become advocates, and change policy and perception of women as we've been impacted by the criminal justice system. And we ally with many people and communities and organizations, and we partner. One of the things that we've been able to do is to facilitate our reentry leadership development course in Bayview Correctional Facility, which is right on 18th Street and West. West Street. And that's huge because we believe that we're the first formerly incarcerated organization that has actually created a curriculum and go back into the prison and facilitate it for women who are coming home. And then our office supports the women once they return. So we've had women come out of the prison and actually come to the office and receive some support from us. And so we continue to talk about policy and advocacy and organizing and bringing oneself to that place of where they identify their power, because power is really presence. And once you have power, you have presence, you can make change. And so that's really important. There are other organizations like Our Children, Providence House Network, which offers mutual aid, the Correctional Association, which offers opportunity for women to learn about advocacy. We're a part of the formerly incarcerated people's movement, which is a national movement building the presence of formerly and convicted people. And women are taking a really important lead in that organizing. And so what can you do? We have a sister circle within our organization. It's made up of professional women like Vicki and Laura, as soon as I corral her in. And we actually partner with women who have this expertise. And actually, what happens is they play an integral role, take on an integral role within the organization, and they assist women as they're coming home with whatever skills. So they partner with women to enhance their skills in various areas. So that's one way you can partner with us, and that's only for the sisters, I'm sorry. So that's the sister circle. And so we also have an event coming up that's through Bread and Roses and Bread. That's April 19th, we'd love 13th. You to come out. 13th, I'm
just
sorry.
Just gave up.
Yes, and they're on the chair. We also have a way in which you can contact us if you want to donate to Worth and see how you can volunteer or come in and offer some education. We'll accept men doing that. So the brochures are on the chair. And I just want to thank you. I think that this is an important conversation, and it needs to be had more often.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. So we've heard history, we've heard personal experiences, we've heard really groundbreaking analysis. We've heard a lot, and I'm sure we're all holding a lot. And so we're gonna move into the community dialogue portion of the evening. But before we do that, can we just give our powerful, righteous panel one more big hand? Thank you. So we ask, in terms of the community dialogue, that we all just try to think about the collective as you are asking your question or making your thought. Think about how much space you're taking up, how much time you're taking up, so that everyone in the collective gets an opportunity to pose their question and share. Okay, can we all sort of agree to do that? Yes, okay. You're gonna shout your question out, I'm gonna repeat it so that we get it on the mic for the recordings and everything that's happening. And we'll take it from there. Ready? Okay. First question.
Is it possible for you to tell us what is happening with incarceration in Europe?
So the question is, what is happening with incarceration in Europe?
Well, I could say one thing, which is that, first of all, you heard the numbers in the beginning, so you know that there is no
the country that has the next most women, I think, is China. Mm-hmm. And then Russia. Anyway, it's really, the use of incarceration is very different. The way that I know it the most personally is that there were women political prisoners, there were political prisoners in Germany, in Britain, and in Italy when I was locked up. And they had to fight for group to be associate with each other in groups. So they fought the use of isolation. Isolation was used in Germany, obviously, you know, think back, the Nazis, and those techniques were used in the prison system. And the political prisoners there staged a fight against it and won, so that they won the right to association, and they dealt a huge blow for to end the use of isolation. Last night, I was at a program that the Correctional Association put on with the Women's Federation from Cuba, and they were talking about, I mean, that's a whole different thing because it's a socialist country, but the way that they described prisons there were actually closer to what we would talk about if we talked about abolition, because they were a way of having people who had broken the law and hurt other people have some system that they went through, but it included their families, they had family contact, they had job education that included being working in the community and then coming back at night, things like that. So I'm not answering so much about this is a whole different social system. But I do think that, one more thing, in Europe, every one of the political prisoners, and remember in Germany, if you don't know, the Bader-Meinhof gang, they were called by the state, and they killed a number of politicians and big businessmen in the 60s, and they got a life sentences for that. Life is 25 years around the world. In the United States, life is life. We have political prisoners who are serving sentences of 75 years to life and 25 to life, and the final thing is they never get out because they can't get parole. So that's a big difference, is the sentencing structure.
Any other questions? Thank you.
In Norway, I think it's 7 years maximum imprisonment.
That makes sense.
For anybody.
I'm Pooja. I work with Raina at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project. And my question is actually for Tina, because I was really moved by your organization and the work that you do. And also, I was thinking that I've been doing this work for a long time and I don't know about it. So that was exciting for me to learn about. And I was wondering if you do work with trans women in particular, if you're open. And I've done some trainings with the Correctional Association in particular. So I feel like I'd be really excited to build with your organization, talk to you more about it.
Yes, we definitely look forward to that. We're definitely aware that we can
use the mics. Can we use the mics?
Yes.
The question was, does Tina's organization do work with trans women? Because folks would really like to connect with her around that.
Our door is open. We definitely do not speak on behalf of any of our sisters inside in their own experience. We definitely know that we've been around that experience, mm-hmm. and we've seen, you know, the oppression. We definitely like to partner with you.
Cool.
Yeah, cool.
Any other questions?
Hi, I have a question. I'm curious to see what role does detention centers play in the prison abolition movement, or what do y'all know about detention centers? Because we're immigrant women or people waiting for deportation.
So the question is about immigration detention centers and the particular impact on women.
Okay.
Or trans or trans folks.
I have some, oh, I have some thoughts. I know Pooja has a lot to say about it, and I wonder, there are other people in the room who have a lot of expertise, and I just wonder if we want to open up the room to other people, not to put Pooja on blast.
Pooja, are you open to speaking?
I think Raina can speak for me.
Raina, you want to take it? Pooja,
come on up.
Raina,
come on.
Yes.
Pooja, would you mind grabbing a mic so that we can get it on recording and everything? You got this.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, thank you, Pooja.
Yeah, could you just say the question again? Sorry.
I was just curious to see where detention roles. What is the role that
detention centers?
What role do they have in the prison abolition movement? Sorry.
Like immigration detention centers. I think everyone on this panel can speak to that. Not just. But I think I could say, I see them as part of the same system in the work that I do. And I think I work with Raina and do legal representation of people who are transgender, gender conforming, and low income people of color who are heavily policed, like Raina explained, right? And I think I think other people could speak more to like the privatization of immigration detention centers and how they're connected to capitalism and just like the prison industrial complex broadly. But I would say that for trans women, for trans people generally, like having traditional access to immigration like routes, like family sponsorship or employment sponsorship, is challenging just because of like systemic inherent discrimination, right, that trans people experience all the time. And so a lot of people I work with are undocumented or have like some kind of limited status, are asylees or have a U visa or something like that. And because of the way that policing plays out, so many trans people end up in local prisons and jails and then are immediately get an immigration hold and are shipped don't even get out, like go from Rikers or another local jail directly to immigration detention centers where they experience like the same system of violence that they experience in jails.
I couldn't have said any.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Okay, I saw hands over here.
Oh, I'm just going to add, in terms of detention centers, there's, I think, and maybe Pooja can correct me, there's some added sort of concerns, particularly for parents, in terms of the fact that like a lot of detention centers don't allow children to visit,
right,
or they only allow like video communication. So like, imagine being a parent, having to see your child through a video screen, you can't even be in the same room as them.
Mm-hmm.
And often you're shipped, I think the average is like 300 miles away from wherever you live. There's like, in terms of breaking apart communities, detention centers there's less laws protecting people's rights. I mean, there's none for prisoners, but like you were saying earlier, like there's none for folks who are incarcerated, but for criminal activity there's even less for folks who are in detention centers.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're saying people in detention centers are at risk of having even more separation of their families, people not being able to see their children, being separated by 300 miles, and all of those types of things. Yep.
I'd like to respond to that, if I could. I don't want to dispute any of it except the idea of more.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's increasingly common within what is more traditionally referred to as the prison system, like, as in the federal and state prison system, there's this proliferation of intensive management units, from the control unit to the maximum control unit to the supermax to the communication management unit to the special management unit. And it isn't uncommon to visit through glass or in the special communication management unit, they have visits through a video TV.
Right.
Which, when I've been contemplating this visit to go out and see somebody and have like a Skype conference with them, it's just very you know, depressing to think about, and you know, knowing someone who had to do that to see his mom. So this is something that is endemic, I think, what I'm learning about the detention system, but also in what is more traditionally known as.
Can I make a point here, which is that, also immigration detention, I learned from Silky Shah, is the place in the prison system as a whole where privatization is the most expansive. And I'm saying that in reaction to what you said, Ainsley, because I think one of the things about prisons in general, and certainly about women and trans people in prison, is that things are done in prisons in the name of us prisoners being the worst of the worst. That's what I was called when I was in a control unit, or the most dangerous, or whatever, or, you know, that immigration detention because we don't want in our country, you know, whatever it is. Once these things are done, once isolation is done so much in prisons, once the patent search is done de rigueur in prisons, then you see stop and frisk on the streets. You see what high schools look like in New York is modeled on prisons. And so once that is the standard, once all that the locks and keys and bars and, you know, checkpoints and searches are standard for, you know, more than 2 million people, then generalizing them to the population is much easier. So that's another point about it. And the things that happen, but just one thing about what Tina was saying about having pregnant women, quote unquote, sitting out in front of the governor's office. One thing we found when I was in prison, there were a huge number compared to what there had been before of women political prisoners. There were Puerto Rican women political prisoners. There were some black women political prisoners in North America. And we found that when the government put us in control units, it was easier to get people on the outside, sort of liberal human rights types, to pay attention because their image of us is that we're vulnerable. Their image of us is not that we're the backbone of resistance, which is what I happen to think. But, you know, and we can use that, but it also exposes at a very basic level. Just like what one of you was saying about trans, the violence against trans and gender nonconforming people exposes the nature of sexual violence in this country and how it has nothing to do with sex, it has to do with violence. Anyway, so that's something that, you know, one reason why I think we do have to continue these conversations, because it will propel forward the entire prison justice and abolition movement.
And just to follow on a really quick optimism note in terms of organizing, it's a really fruitful like conjunction because like immigrant like organizing around detention does intersect with the wider prison abolition movement, and so it's one of the ways to kind of build like broader sectors, yeah. Which is not always easy to do.
Mm-hmm. My question is: there's been all this publicity about the hunger strikes and the food in the hunger strikes happening in California, I think a couple other states, and it's all very focused on men's prisons. And I'm just wondering if you all, as experts in this field, know what's happening in women's prisons around, if there's any of that going on with women's prisons in California, and what that looks like.
So the questions about the hunger strikes, the recent hunger strikes that have been taking place in resistance in men's prisons around the country, and whether or not folks in women's prisons are taking on similar acts of resistance.
I'm not hearing anything.
Well, when the hunger strikes happened in California in July, women in Valley State Prison for Women in California also went on hunger strike because they also have a secure housing unit, which is like a 23 to 24 hour lockup unit. Like it's basically like all the time solitary confinement with like lights on, like no human contact, et cetera, et cetera. So they also launched their own hunger strike, both in solidarity with the Pelican Bay hunger strike, but also to protest their own conditions of confinement. I don't know if when the hunger strikes began again in September, if they also launched a hunger strike. There had been no news about that. And even women who'd been involved with going out to Valley State Prison for Women and the other prison in Chowchilla, the two huge women's prison complexes,
weren't really sure what was going on. So I think it's harder to get news out from there, and especially because there's less attention paid to women's prisons, oftentimes it's easier for them to get overlooked. I know that like in Indiana, one woman decided to go on like her own like one day hunger strike in solidarity because she was like, hey, I'm also in like the solitary confinement unit. So when she heard about that, she did. But again, I feel like these are actions that people don't necessarily look for. And because women in prison get less support than men do, sort of like overall generally, you know, like people aren't really necessarily, they don't have the outlets to then be able to get that information in or out as easily.
This is not to answer your question, because I think you answered it really well. But just that one of the things that we talk about a lot at Sylvia Vera Law Project is that there are women in men's prisons, and there are men in women's prisons, and there are people who don't identify as men or women in men's prisons and in women's prisons. So to just to complicate the idea that everyone in a men's prison is a man and everyone in a woman's prison is a woman, I think it's really important to bring into this conversation again, and you did in your earlier part, and I really appreciate that. So.
Can you speak to censorship and misinformation? Mm.
So the question is about censorship and misinformation that goes on in the prison system.
Yes, as a means to really stop and control as part of the mechanism to prevent.
Do you mean in stuff that's coming into the prisons or in messages that are going out, or both?
Resistance on both ways.
Yeah.
You know, how is it used, the enforcement and abuse of those who inside or subjected to different censorships and misinformation. So those things that go on inside prisons, a lot of the public, general public, don't know, or they're getting the wrong message. So they can, you know, say, well, dehumanize, you know, there's no need to take any efforts towards the harm that they have.
So it sounds like the question is about censorship and misinformation inside the prison, and also censorship and misinformation in the public about what's going on in the prison.
The difficulties of those activists, organizations, to get in reach and share and dialogue about issues that go on.
This is just a small one, because there's a lot that we work with people who are incarcerated in the Prisoner Advisory Committee, and we do regular mailings. We have a lot of correspondence with them. We have a newsletter called In Solidarity, where people exchange information back and forth. So trans people incarcerated in one detention center or prison get to interact with other people, and that's a really powerful tool. But on the outside, something that just happened was Pooja and I were asked by the New York Times to write an op-ed yesterday, and about hate crimes legislation and what trans and gender nonconforming people have to deal with. And we wrote about local law enforcement in the prison industrial complex being a source of violence in trans and gender nonconforming people's lives. And as soon as the editor from the New York Times read that he flipped out and pulled the story, right? And I think that like, that's kind of, you know, we don't expect the New York Times to share our lives and share our stories, but it was very much about talking about how the prison system and law enforcement are sources of violence in our life. And as soon as that was understood, he said he can't publish that.
So we had developed a short survey because we have members inside, we have 5 prisons in New York State, and we have members inside, and we developed a survey where we were asking women if they had been impacted, or the Rockefeller drug law changes had affected them in some way. Had they begun their appeals? If they met the criteria? Were they resentenced on a violation? Or, you know, and we received a letter from the research department within the Department of Corrections saying that we could not send in any letters with questions unless we had approval. Prior to that, we received responses from women under legal mail, and now we don't receive any responses from them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They have to have stamps. So we're trying to figure out a way that we could send someone money for their commissary, so that, you know, we have to think about ways in which we can do this, so that we can continue these communications. But that's how we're stopped, because they know that we will do from this information what we need to do on the outside, so that things change for them on the inside. Yeah. But that's something that's recently happened, and we're brainstorming around how we can address that.
Right.
Now we're not able to get in.
That's perfect. I want to give some particular examples from when I was inside. I think my favorite one was when there was a newspaper called Gay Community News out of Boston in the early days, and actually it was our best source of information about HIV/AIDS, which was a huge and still is issue in prisons. And I was told, this newspaper had all kinds of articles that were very radical. And it got in. I was in the federal system at that point. They were letting things. And one time it was barred. I was told, I got a little slip in the mail call. And the reason it was because it promoted homosexuality. Well, if anyone remembers Gay Community News, it was a gay
right.
newspaper, so it had taken them a while. But the reason was that there was this one picture. They had to show me, I grieved it, and they had to show me. The picture was a tiny little picture of two women in bed together, not kissing, not having sex, just lying in bed together, and that to me spoke volumes. Anything that was supposed to be promoting, especially lesbianism in women's prisons in the federal system, was seen as a huge threat, and I could go into the role of the fundamentalist church in there and stuff like that. I also did want to just mention this. Safia Boukhari was a former Panther and political prisoner, and she died in 2003. And there's a book of her writings on the back table. And someone in Pelican Bay ordered a copy from the press, and the press got the copy back and said this is barred because it's gang related, because the Black Panther Party was judged to be a gang. In New York State, there is currently a prisoner, Jaleel Muntakim, doing 6 months of box time at solitary punishment for having received in the mail a program from a memorial for a number of ex-Black Panthers who had died in the last year. So these were pictures of people who had been in the Black Panther Party, and he was charged also with unauthorized or gang literature. So the control of what comes in. And just one last thing is that when I was in prison, there was remember the crack and powder cocaine disparities in sentencing, and the first time that was being voted on in the Sentencing Commission decided against equalizing the punishments. And throughout the prison system, in the federal system, there were uprisings, there were riots, and there was one in the prison I was in, and Susie hooked me up with a journalist, Touré, who's now writes in New York, and I had a phone conversation with him, and he said, "People in prison understand what's going on in Congress?" And so I thought, whoa, that shows what people think of prisoners. So the last thing I just want to say is that when we did HIV/AIDS work, we had a health fair in every prison I was in, and one, all the women who worked in the AIDS group, and this is not just white women, it was mostly Black and Latino women, and a few of us were white, put on this health fair. And so all these different health groups came in to do booths. And one of them was the Red Cross to do a stop smoking thing. So these sort of churchy ladies from rural California came in, and we were setting up. So they came into the place where we were setting up the health fair. And there were about, I think, 13 or 14 of us. And this woman said, "Oh, and when do the prisoners come?" And I said to her, "Well, we're all prisoners." And I really thought she was going to faint. She got all pale. So, because she had this image of prisoners. And so in terms of misinformation, that's the other thing. Oz, all those, I don't like those shows. All the violence they show, because here we are. We are the worst of the worst.
I don't know what the situation is at the moment, but some years ago when I worked in the state of Mississippi, the prison system was closely connected to the plantation system. And many of the prisoners were able or forced, they received a tiny payment for work on the farms. Some of them told me that they were shackled, their leg shackled while they worked, and with, no kidding, ball and chain. This was 1964 in the state of Mississippi. So I don't know what the situation is at the moment, but it was connected to the farming system, the industrial system of that state, and probably in New York State, prison work is connected to the whatever industries we have in Buffalo and other places and so on, I would think.
So it sounds like a question about the connection between prison, prison labor, chattel slavery, and how prison labor is exploited.
Local economy, yeah. Mm-hmm. The wages were pennies.
Yep. Any thoughts?
In Angela Davis's book, Are Prisons Obsolete? She talks about the three institutions. She talks about segregation and lynching. And what's the other one? Let me think about it. Segregation, lynching, and slavery. That we've abolished segregation and lynching, but slavery still goes on. And it does, it's within our prison system. So if you think of the wages a person receives, I think it's $1.54 a week. You know, when I was in prison, I was at this boot camp called Shock, and we would actually work in the community. We actually did the jobs that should have been available to the people in the community, as opposed to it being prisoners for hire within, you know, in the community. We worked in the sewage plant, we worked in a toy factory, we worked in various industries within the community. And, you know, it was definitely slave labor. We had to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and go back to bed, go back to our housing unit, and get in bed by, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night, and it was day after day after day. And I know that this particular situation isn't just isolated. You know, I know throughout all of the prison systems that we have. I used to work in Sing Sing. And I taught parenting there. And I would speak to the men who were about to, their classification was about to get lowered because they were eligible for parole or soon, or, you know, when their classification, do you know what classification is? Okay, so so their classification was lowered where they were able to go to a medium facility, and most of those facilities were facilities where there were industry, and they would actually look to go to those facilities so that they could work and save more money because they would make more money than $1.50, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
What makes me think about the 13th Amendment, right? Which abolishes slavery, except in the case of people who are in prison. And that's currently in the Constitution. It lives, it breathes, it's real.
Right.
It's a part of the fabric of our society right now.
So slavery's not a right.
Other thoughts, panel something?
One other thing I wanted to point out, which is not necessarily like plantation, you know, in prison, but it's that in the states that are getting that are passing anti-immigrant measures, like Arizona, like Colorado, like Alabama, they're using people in prison to replace the immigrant workers that had been coming and working. So Arizona, in Colorado in 2007, when they passed stringent anti-immigrant law and migrant workers weren't coming back to work on the farms, the farmers put up a big clamor and they said, you know, who's going to pick all our fruit and our crops and everything? So the legislature passed authorization for them to be able to hire people in prison. But when you think about the fact that the majority of people in prison come from urban areas, they don't know how to farm. You know, they don't know how to farm, they're not used to backbreaking work. And so they started sending out farm crews in the women's prison, and they would start shuffling women around. So it didn't matter if you were in an education program or if you were in some sort of other program. If you didn't qualify to go to the farm crew, they would ship you off to another prison and bring somebody in who was able to work on this farm crew. And women would go out there and, you know, mistakes were made because they didn't know a weed from a crop. You know, they would work long, backbreaking hours.
for a little bit more money than they would make if they were mopping the floor in the prison. And the prison industry would say, like, oh, we're teaching them skills. Like, you know, like, we're teaching them, like, some sort of, like, skill that will be marketable when they get out. Which, you know, well, you can kind of think, like, that's really not going to be the case. But then in Colorado in 2008, one of the farm workers, the incarcerated farm workers, died on the field. Like, I guess she never should have been cleared to go out to be on the farm and do this backbreaking labor, but because the prison gets paid per person who goes out on the field that day, they just kind of overlooked the fact that she had asthma or respiratory illness, and she was working in the sun, weeding or picking crops or whatever people do on the farm, and then she said she wasn't feeling well, so instead of taking her someplace and getting her medical attention, she was told to sit under the shade of a tree, and that's where she died. And then Colorado did not learn this lesson, so they continue to send women out and men out to go work on farms to replace immigrant labor. Arizona has also followed suit, I'm sure, with the passing of the anti-immigrant legislation in Alabama. They're also, you know, going to start looking at who can replace the migrant laborers that have left to do this work cheaply, even if it's not efficiently. So we can kind of see how this all kind of like meshes together. When you've got like one population driven out, like what can you use to replace that?
Absolutely, thank you. So we'll take maybe one or two more questions or comments, and we'll do a collective closing, and hopefully we'll all be able to unite with each other before we leave. So any additional questions, thoughts, comments?
I have a question about organizing. I was wondering if anyone on the panel could talk about how any of you talk to folks who maybe are new or have questions about prison abolition or the work that you do, about how you talk about them, how you break down those sort of barriers and assumptions that people have about how, what prison's purposes are and who prisoners are.
So thoughts or advice from the panelists on how to talk to into people in the community about prison abolition, injustices due to the prison system. How do we do it?
Well, I'll start. It's when you're a former prisoner and you break the people's idea of what a former prisoner looks like, that gives you a leg up to do it. But, I think it's really important to find out from people what they think prisons are for, because one thing I find a lot, and when if I say abolition, people say, but my community isn't safe. A guy came to our meeting a few weeks ago at Occupy and said that. He said, if you're going to talk about abolition, and I think the point, and I think the issue of women, again, makes this really clear, is that prisons don't make our communities safe. They undermine our communities by removing people for long times, by disenfranchising them, by destabilizing them, by creating more violence. And for a friend of ours, or someone else who works in the New York State Prison Justice Network in Albany, who did for years work with and works in a battered women's center, said she was at a meeting and the women were talking about where they turned the lights out. This was not about prisons. They turned the lights out and people could speak anonymously about their history of sexual abuse and of having been attacked sexually on the streets. And at the end, they were talking about remedies. And she realized that what she wanted to say was that prisons are not, they do nothing to resolve the problem of rape, etc. They create more violence because of the repression. When you repress people, violence is an outcome. So I think that's one thing that's really important. But I really think it's important to talk about to people about what they think. And, you know, a lot of times people don't, I mean, when I talk about political prisoners, sometimes a lot of the people I work with, I work in HIV in a magazine, they don't agree. They don't think, as I do, that there was this righteous liberation movement in the 70s and the people who broke the laws as part of that, you know, after 40 years should be let out of prison. But we talk about it. They don't think that, that Mumia Abu-Jamal's case is so important and stuff, but we talk about it, and over time, you know, as long as we listen and don't talk our own language, it's why sometimes I get a little uncomfortable with the term prison industrial complex, because unless we explain it, you know, it can sound like rhetoric that people don't know about. To me, it sounds like when people talk about HIV and they talk about, you know, these big scientific terms and all. So I just think it's really important to, for building healthier communities, that also means healthier communication. I don't know if that was very helpful, but.
I would also say that it's different, you know, obviously depending on who you're talking to, but to sort of characterize it, like, in speaking with people who have a lot of direct personal experience with the prison system, one thing that I noticed, and I think, like, actually both of you can speak to this, and Janae probably knows more about this than anyone in this room, which is this real emphasis on individual responsibility, personal responsibility. So, for example, in, like, ATI programs, alternatives to incarceration programs, like you seeing the sign on the wall that says pull up your pants, right? And in some of the conversations in those spaces, it's a lot about like this sense of like individual responsibility or kind of exceptionalism, like, you know, my kid was a good kid, like this shouldn't have happened to my kid was good, I raised my kid right. As like the pain of sort of seeing the real systemic challenge and how absolutely painful that is to confront. And so in a way that is a barrier to looking at it as a like really widespread problem, you know, like you don't want to know about it, it's painful. And then in terms of speaking with like folks who aren't very impacted, like I think one of the big barriers is that it's sort of on the periphery, right? It's like prisons take people away. And so it's on the margin, it's where people don't have to think about it. They don't have to see it. If you have a class and race, if you're situated in a race group that's not part of your personal experience, like it's like that's the whole point, is it disappears people. And in those conversations though, I do think there is a way to like actually ask, what do you think happens to people in prison? And I don't think very many people like have some idea that people come out of prison like, you know, less problematic than they were when they went in. Like, I don't think anybody really thinks that. You know, so in a way, what I was talking about earlier with like this whole idea of consent, is it fixable? I think that actually people's consent is maybe a little thinner than we think it is, or can actually be challenged. And that's something that I want to really think about in organizing allies and trying to figure out like, well, what is the support for this whole thing and where are the different places that we could attack it?
I used to be on staff at Critical Resistance, and one of the things that we did all the time was talk about what the prison industrial complex is and what abolition is, and we had great exercises and we had workshops, but I think one of the big turning points for me in terms of how to talk about abolition was when New York City tried to build a jail in the South Bronx specifically. They wanted to build a women's jail with a nursery, and there was all this rhetoric coming from the Department of Corrections saying it's going to be closer to your community, it's going to have a nice nursery, you won't have to drive all the way to Rikers, it's going to cost X amount of money, and we really got a chance to break it down. And as a person who like grew up my entire youth going to see my parent who was incarcerated, I think a lot of us could connect to, yeah, it really sucks to travel really far to see a parent who's incarcerated, but instead of building a jail that's maybe a little bit closer, in reality it wasn't at all, instead of building a jail that's maybe let people out, right? And maybe, you know, people are in jail, like just jail, so many people are in jail because you can't afford to not be, right? Because bail is too high, and you can't afford to pay bail. And you know, or you're not getting a desk ticket. And so there's all these things that people, we kind of forget in our political landscape that are really simple, that are maybe reform strategies that fit into an abolitionist, that fit into an abolitionist imagination. That we can say, well, actually, does it make sense to build a jail that costs $375 million? What would we want to do with $375 million? Does it make sense to build a jail on a toxic land site? What do you think should happen with this toxic land site? Does it make sense to build a jail with a nursery? Why would it make sense to build a jail with a nursery? And also, you know, just really have those questions that are very specific And for me, it was really fundamental in how I think about prison abolition as starting specific and going wider.
Mm-hmm. Oh, can I, just when you were talking about bail, I just wanted to say that one of the things that has come out of one of the Occupy groups is watch for this, and if you're interested, maybe we can do, you know, email things, is a project called Bailout NYC. And their plan is that a lot of public defenders have said that they have clients who are in jail waiting for trial only because they can't pay their bail. And there's no reason for them to, you know, being locked up before you go to trial is a real hindrance to the very slim possibility of being acquitted anyway. So the idea is that on May Day, a fund would have been started so that every single person who's in jail in New York City and has a public defender will be bailed out. And I loved it because it reminded me of like the Bastille or, you know, French Revolution, or this sense of challenging people's consciousness exactly about who's in prison and why. So sometimes having some campaign like that that's so general is also a way of attaching the discussions to something particular. So please look for that campaign and contribute or do some part of it.
Okay, last thing. Does anyone have anything burning? Yes? Yes, no?
I was just having something tag on the conversation that was just happening. In 2007, the U.S. Social Forum, there was about 700 people, a conversation about prison abolition put on by critical resistance. And the biggest thing I saw in that conversation was this massive divide between people educated, highly educated, on the outside, and had been on the outside, and folks that were there most affected by the prison industrial complex. And it was like the room divided and the conversation was really heated. And so I think around organizing, especially around prisons, like putting the people that are most affected and their communities in the forefront is absolutely the most imperative thing. And academics need to take a side. So that's my burning desire.
last one. What's
no. I'll leave it to after.
You have a question?
After.
You're going to leave it to after?
After sessions.
After sessions? Okay.
My question is, you guys are a wealth of information for everybody here. Would you guys list some other organizations or groups or just other ways to connect people in different capacities?
Okay, additional resources. What do folks got?
I'll name one, which is the Transgender Intersex Justice Project. It's in California, and the executive director is Miss Major, who is a Stonewall veteran, and they work specifically with people who are coming out, mostly trans women who are coming out of prison. And then the Sylvia Rivera Law Project works in a building. We're really lucky to share a building with the Audre Lorde Project, Fierce, and Queers for Economic Justice, which all do in their own ways organizing around the prison industrial complex. So those are four organizations I'd say check out.
I know that the panel has been pretty focused on seemingly like adult women or sort of women in general. I work specifically with youth, as does Janae, and Janae is incredibly humble, so I'm just going to speak on her behalf. But it was mentioned in her bio that she is building an organization called Youth Generation for young people who are impacted by this, who are serious about wanting a space to share their feelings and also to take action around the prison industrial complex, the school to prison pipeline, stop and frisk, all the ways that youth are impacted by this to have a space. So Youth Generation, you can talk to Janae about it. The email address is youthgeneration@cca.org. CCAYouth.org. youthgeneration@CCAYouth.org. If you know young people 13 to 18, am I right, who are interested in getting involved.
There's a lot of momentum around stop and frisk and work against stop and frisk in specifically Vocal New York, where the Voices of Community Activists and Leaders is working on some actions coming up. And if any of you would be interested, Vocal also has a role for allies in the upcoming actions. And you would be welcome to talk to me and I can connect you.
Worth is going back to the legislation that was passed in Shaklin. There were a couple of recommendations by Governor Patterson at the time where he believed that the use of one handcuff should be eliminated, and also based on the woman's classification, meaning her violent status or non-violent status, should determine whether she's handcuffed or not. Be taken off of the legislative, the law as it is. So we're revisiting the Shaklin legislation, rewriting the legislation, and we are going to look for people to ally with us and change this law even further so that it includes the safety of the mother and the child.
Last group. It's not so much organizing or movement building, but how to like support people inside, you know, like through their confinement is Books Through Bars, New York City. Can somebody from Books Through Bars stand up? We send free literature to people inside prisons across the nation. So if you have books or other literature that you're really not going to read again, because I know people like to hoard their books, you know, like, we will gladly take them and we will send them to people for whom that might be the only piece of reading material that they get. So, you know, there's Anika there, you can talk to me. There's a couple of other people hiding behind Anika that you can talk to. You know, we can give you information on, like, how to get your books to us and, like, how we can send them out.
Thank you. And just really one quick thing, Laura. Just speaking of books,
yeah.
And then you go. Speaking of books, we have some books on the topic, some of which have been written or edited by some of the folks around this table. Were we having the same thought?
Yeah.
Okay. Right in the back, through Blue Stockings Books. So folks should feel free to stop by the table and check out the literature that's back there.
And on the table is a free newsletter that's put out by a wonderful group of HIV and prison justice activists in Philadelphia called Prison Health News, and take one. And if you write to prisoners, send it inside, and then get the address and, you know, put people, that's, it goes free to prisoners, and it gives really useful, good health news, mostly about HIV/AIDS, but not only.
Okay, so let's stand and raise our collective voice before we get out of here. Before we leave, I thought it might be nice for us to chant together and be in unity. Have folks heard of the Asada chant? Folks know it? So for folks who know it, can you do the call with me? Folks who don't know it can do the response, and then I'll show you how we do it in a really dramatic way. So for folks who know it, it is our duty to fight.
It is our duty to fight. It is our duty to win.
We must love and protect one another. We have nothing to lose but our chains. So, to be dramatic, right? Because movement, you know, drama is a part of the movement, right? We're going to whisper. The first time we say it, say it three times, we're going to whisper. The second time we say it, we're going to speak in a normal sort of speaking voice. And the third time we say it, as you've probably guessed by now, we're going to shout as loud as we can so that all the people behind the walls can hear us, so that all the people in the community can hear us, okay? Y'all ready? Okay. And oh, I guess I'll say it in the mic for folks who don't know. Y'all can repeat that. It is our duty to fight.
It is our duty to fight. It is our duty to win.
We must love and protect one another. We have nothing to lose but our chains.
It is our duty to fight!